Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is the 17th of August, 2002, and today's session is two big little stories about death and culture, presented by Ingrid Christensen, and it's tape number CH1-2002-11. Let's listen in.
I'm Ingrid Christensen, and this is a session on story writing. I mean, not story writing, it's a session on stories, story reading. And I'm going to read two stories today. We'll have time to do two because they're both very short. And they're both out of this book, which has been in the bookstore, but which is sold out twice already this summer, called You've Got to Read This. And it's a wonderful collection of short stories. Contemporary American writers introduced stories that held them in awe. So the editors, Hanson and Shepherd, have asked some of their favorite writers to choose a story to include in the book and then to write the introduction to it. So if you run across this book in your bookstores, in your homes, you will enjoy it, I think, if you read it. I mean, if you pick it up, if you like short stories. I'm going to read two stories, one by Alice Walker called The Flowers, and one called by Leslie Marmon Silko called The Man to Send Rain Clouds. The two stories have a few things in common. One is that they both are quite culturally bedded, so that they each come out of a culture. The first one, Alice Walker's, comes out of a Southern African American culture. And the second one, Leslie Silko's, comes out of a Native American culture. And the facts of the story are affected by those cultures. Their cultures produce the story, in a sense. So they have that in common. Another thing that they have in common is that they both involve a death, and therefore all the kind of attendant attitudes about death that would be cultural and that would be human and personal. And so it isn't too much of a stretch, I think, to put them together. And the third thing that they have in common is that both authors have a style, a tone, which is very egalitarian. And it's interesting to see how that works itself out. The authors respect their readers. They respect the culture that they're writing about. I think both the sort of sense of who they are and who they're writing about and who they assume will read this are interesting, almost characters in the stories. The first one we're going to do is Alice Walker's story. It's a page and a half long. And a couple of things to think about while I'm reading it. One is, does the author trust us? And with what does the author trust us? The title image, the flowers, are of course important in the story. If you think of a story as a place where something happens, what happens in this story? What changes? I would urge you to think about the possibility of change on many levels. So what is the story about? And that would be another question about change. There are circular images in the story, and you don't notice them the first time through sometimes, so I'd like you to kind of look for them. And then, as I've already said, who is it written for? So with that said, we'll hear the story, and then we'll have a chance to talk about it. And then we'll go on to the longer, so a little bit longer story by Silko. Look how brief it is.
Oh. What's the collection?
The collection is You've Got to Read This. Contemporary American writers introduced stories that held them in awe. So it's stories chosen by writers as their favorite story. The person who introduces this story, The Flowers, is Edward P. Jones. He says that it's a perfect story for teaching story writing to young aspiring writers. The only character in it is a woman called Maya, young girl called Maya, M-Y-O-P. She's 10 years old. It seemed to Maya, as she skipped lightly from hen house to pig pen to smokehouse, that the days had never been as beautiful as these. The air held a keenness that made her nose twitch. The harvesting of the corn and cotton, peanuts and squash, made each day a golden surprise that caused excited little tremors to run up her jaws. Maya carried a short, knobby stick. She struck out at random at chickens she liked and worked out the beat of a song on the fence around the pig pen. She felt light and good in the warm sun. She was 10, and nothing existed for her but her song, the stick clutched in her dark brown hand, and the ta-ta-da-ta of accompaniment. Turning her back on the rusty boards of her family's sharecropper cabin, Maya walked along the fence until it ran into the stream made by the spring. Around the spring, where the family got drinking water, silver ferns and wild flowers grew. Along the shallow banks, pigs rooted. Maya watched the tiny white bubbles disrupt the thin black scale of soil, and the water that silently rose and slid away down the stream. She had explored the woods behind the house many times. Often, in late autumn, her mother took her to gather nuts among the fallen leaves. Today, she made her own path, bouncing this way and that way, vaguely keeping an eye out for snakes. She found, in addition to various common but pretty ferns and leaves, an armful of strange blue flowers with velvety ridges and a sweet suds bush full of brown, fragrant buds. By 12 o'clock, her arms were laden with sprigs of her finding, and she was a mile or more from home. She had often been as far before, but the strangeness of the land made it not as pleasant as her usual haunts. It seemed gloomy in the little cove in which she found herself. The air was damp, the silence close and deep. Maya began to circle back to the house, back to the peacefulness of the morning. It was then she stepped smack into his eyes. Her heel became lodged in the broken ridge between brow and nose, and she reached down quickly, unafraid, to free herself. It was only when she saw his naked grin that she gave a little yelp of surprise. He had been a tall man, from feet to neck covered a long space. His head lay beside him. When she pushed back the leaves and layers of earth and debris, Maya saw that he'd had large white teeth, all of them cracked or broken, long fingers, and very big bones. All his clothes had rotted away except some threads of blue denim from his overalls. The buckles of the overalls had turned green. Maya gazed around the spot with interest. Very near where she'd stepped into the head was a wild pink rose. As she picked it to add to her bundle, she noticed a raised mound, a ring, around the rose's root. It was the rotted remains of a noose, a bit of shredding plow line, now blending benignly into the soil. Around an overhanging limb of grape-spreading oak clung another piece, frayed, rotted, bleached, and frazzled, barely there, but spinning restlessly in the breeze. Maya laid down her flowers, and the summer was over. Hard to know what to say.
Did she trying to bury a body, an old corpse or something? Is that what that was? Okay. It sound like a giant?
I think it was a tall man.
Oh, okay.
So what happens in the story?
It sounded like she was homeless. Plus people, you know, from space to space. Or just on the go?
She was just on the go. She was 10 years old and she was out walking in the morning. Okay.
She puts the flowers there because she knows that he's dead. And she says she laid the flowers down.
good for you. Yeah, she put her flowers on his grave.
Right.
And he was right there, laying there. And it says she was not afraid of him. Patsy?
You said what changes was she was just having a happy-go-lucky day, and then she would stumble up on the body. And then, it was like she had, a little memorial thing going.
Mm-hmm.
Flowers and stuff.
Right.
More so was the violence that she knew took place, that she perhaps had not been directly affected by before, knowing that people are being hung and taken away from their families. She probably had heard the stories but not actually been confronted with it face to face before.
Mm-hmm.
And the ropes and the violence, and she probably felt a deep caring for the person that she didn't know.
Mm-hmm. And the person had probably been lying there longer than she'd been alive.
Years.
At least 10. The skeleton may well have been there for 40 years or whatever.
When it starts out, she's in the here and now, like it's a lovely day, and she's responding to just immediately what's around in the here and now, like the sky and the animals and the flowers, and just going with the moment. But the instant she steps into this scene where someone's dead, it's like the past comes back. You know, that history, you can't leave history behind, so... confronted with more than the here and now, because it's not just the corpse that is there, but what it's meant in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And so, sort of, you could never leave that black, horrible, violent past behind.
So the story actually, within a very few lines, teaches us something about a cultural heritage that we have. It says we're. This whole page, she's going from pig pen to stream to spring to picking flowers and doing all of that. And well, actually, right there, two paragraphs before the end, she steps into the skull. She steps into the eyes and nose openings in the skull. And her heel becomes lodged in it. So she's caught, isn't she? She's caught by this past. She's never going to be the same. He had been a tall man, and then it describes him. His clothes had rotted away, except a little blue denim. The buckles of the overalls had turned green. So she knows it's from a very long time ago. But she recognizes those things. She gazed around the spot with interest. Now, this is a 10-year-old girl with a lot of courage, I would say. She has a sort of, brings some calmness, fortitude, and flexibility. Very near where she'd stepped into the head was a wild pink rose. As she picked it to add to her bundle, she noticed a raised mound, a ring around the rose's root. A ring around the rose's root. A nice line. So there was a ring, a sort of a mound with a rose tree or bush coming up in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
It was the rotted remains of a noose, a bit of shredded plow line, now blending benignly into the soil. You know, the thing in itself, the noose, the rope, wasn't a bad thing. It was benign, but made into a noose, it made into this circle, with the rose growing out of the middle of it. Around an overhanging limb above of a great spreading oak clung another piece, frayed, bleached, and frazzled, barely there, so a really old rope, but spinning restlessly in the breeze. And then the next line is, Maya laid down her flowers. So it was like this progression into the story of understanding. The more she looked, the more she saw, the more she understood.
Mm-hmm.
And finally she realized this man had been hung from that tree and left there
to rot and to decay and to become bones without any dignity of a burial. You know, as soon as she, that hit her, she laid down her flowers. Mm-hmm. And then the last line of the story is, and the summer was over. Now, we haven't had any discussion about the summer until now. So what does that mean?
All the fun, all that. She started, probably started to take life seriously.
She grew up in some way.
She grew up in a mature, in a mature form mentality. It changed her.
It changed her. And it changed her both through an understanding of the immediate horror of the situation and through an understanding of the historical horror of the situation. So in these few lines, this Alice Walker really shows us. And does she do that to us too? I mean, are we affected by this story?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it just an idle tale?
One thing that really struck me was this image, the circle images, because I was sort of watching for those. But at one point, just before she finds the skull, it's like she's just getting ready to circle back to the safety and the familiarity of home, where everything was comfortable, and you know, and you sort of knew she could never circle back quite to that safe place. That it was also forever changed.
Yeah, right.
She could never quite circle back. I mean, the circle of the noose and the incredible symbols all through that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? It seems like they mean the summer's over for her. It don't seem like they're talking about the summer's over, period. Mm-hmm. It seems like the summer's over for her.
Mm-hmm.
The summer of her life is over. Her innocence mm-hmm. is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Her childhood innocence is no longer what it was and will never be again. So it's the summer of portion of her life, which is the fun part.
Mm-hmm.
Well, life to her is no longer a mystery. It's no longer hidden from her. She, you know, explored. That was a great experience.
Yeah. It should, so the whole representation of summer is a gathering of flowers, and she was mm-hmm. a flower gatherer. Gather ye rosebuds while you may. You mm-hmm. know, she gathered those flowers and then laid them down for a memorial and also to represent the end of her innocence and the.
The one thing in the story that struck me is, if I were writing it, I'm sorry, I would probably assume that a 10-year-old girl stepping into her skull would have a moment of revulsion.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't happen in this story.
She gives a little yelp of surprise.
Just surprise. That's all.
What
she's calm through the whole thing. I can't, it's just, you know, I have a sense if I stood into a skull, my stomach would, you know, churn.
Yeah.
So I have this sense of what an amazing portrait of a child. I think the writer is doing something to us there.
Yeah. Why could this child hang on to her cookies at that point?
And have to keep her flowers.
She, there's some reasoning but there that she was very much grounded in the physical reality of that life. She talks about the spring that they get their water from is where the pigs root around too, and that she goes to along the shallow banks the pigs rooted. She knows about the physical facts of life. She goes from pig pen to smokehouse to hen house. She gives a little knock at her favorite chicken, strikes out at random at chickens she liked. So she is a on the ground child. She knows about a lot of the facts of life. I'm sure she's seen animals slaughtered and prepared for smoking and in smokehouse and eating. But this is a human, and I think it's partly the author's saying because it was a progress of things that happened. She had to first figure out what she'd gotten into that was stuck on her. And then once she realized that, then she looked at it and saw that it was a skeleton lying there, half buried, And then she saw the noose, and then she saw the frayed rope, and so it was step, 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 step. And then the summer was over.
It's almost like a metaphor of Americans coming to terms with history.
Mm-hmm. And she probably had sympathy for that skeleton too.
I'm sure she does.
I'm sure she did, because she laid her flowers that she gathered for herself, and she sacrificed those flowers. Realized that this man had no funeral. Nobody probably don't even know he's here, but the people who hung him up there, mm-hmm. you know, or suicide, whatever.
Yeah, you would imagine that his family would come and get him later if he'd been.
Somebody knew.
Yeah.
And she probably felt some sympathy.
Well, I also feel she's very sensitive, because when she walked into that space, there was an oppression. How was it described?
Right.
Before she ever stepped into the skull, there was a darkness. There was something, some wording there that indicated she already felt something was not normal, or something was not safe, something was.
And then another way that Alice Walker is brilliant, that paragraph reads, by 12 o'clock, so, you know, it's the midday, it's the sun is at its height, and then it starts to go down, you know. But by 12 o'clock, her arms laden with sprigs of her findings, she was a mile or more from home. She had often been as far before, but the strangeness of the land made it not as pleasant as her usual haunts. It seemed gloomy in the little cove in which she found herself. The air was damp, the silence close and deep. So there was something that changed there before this happened. So that was even a previous step to these other steps that happened. That suddenly there was something, felt a little evil there. It felt close and damp and dark and not just at the height of the day and her happiness. It's such a lovely story. I think we need, if we're going to get the other one in, we're going to move on. But think of the other one and this in a relationship. The other one is a much happier story. I wanted to do this one first so that we would end with a little happier place. Leslie Marmon Silko is a Native American woman, and she has written this perfectly spectacular story called The Man to Send Rain Clouds. I should say a few things I'm supposed to look for. Again, the tone is interesting. You know, the way the author thinks of the reader is the respect kind of that's there or not there. There are tons of colors in this story. Red, blue, green, yellow, gold, white, gray. There may even be more that I've missed. Red occurs over and over again, as does blue. The other thing about color is that sunlight and shadow are very important in the story. So think about those things. Then there's an incredible rhythm that goes back and forth between sacred things and mundane things. So mundane means ordinary, the most common, like dirt on your shoes, and sacred is sacred. The characters, Teofilo is the old man. Then there's two couples, Leon and Louise is one couple, and Ken and Teresa are another couple. And then there's a priest called Father Paul. An interesting question in this is what kind of religious faith or belief does everybody in the story have? What evidence do we have for faith and belief? There's a phrase that's used several times, it's okay. What do they mean when they say it's okay? Then there's some evidence given to us by Leslie Marmon Silko about what the priest, who's an Anglo, a white man, thinks about the Indians who are his parishioners. And I think it's an important thing to watch for clues about what he thinks. The man to send rain clouds. They found him under a big cottonwood tree. His Levi jacket and pants were faded light blue, so that he had been easy to find. The big cottonwood tree stood apart from a small grove of winter-bare cottonwoods which grew in the wide, sandy arroyo. He had been dead for a day or more, and the sheep had wandered and scattered up and down the arroyo. Leon and his brother-in-law Ken gathered the sheep and left them in the pen at the sheep camp before they returned to the cottonwood tree.
Leon waited under the tree while Ken drove the truck through the deep sand to the edge of the arroyo. He squinted up at the sun and unzipped his jacket. It sure was hot for this time of year. But high in northwest, the Blue Mountains were still in snow. Ken came sliding down the low, crumbling bank about 50 yards down, and he was bringing the red blanket. Before they wrapped the old man, Leon took a piece of string out of his pocket and tied a small gray feather in the old man's long white hair. Ken gave him the paint. Across the brown, wrinkled forehead, he drew a streak of white, and along the high cheekbones, he drew a strip of blue paint. He paused and watched Ken throw pinches of cornmeal and pollen into the wind that fluttered the small gray feather. Then Leon painted with yellow under the old man's broad nose, and finally, when he had painted green across the chin, he smiled. "Send us rain clouds, Grandfather." They laid the bundle in the back of the pickup and covered it with a heavy tarp before they started back to the Pueblo. They turned off the highway onto the sandy Pueblo road. Not long after they passed the store and post office, they saw Father Paul's car coming toward them. When he recognized their faces, he slowed his car and waved for them to stop. The young priest rolled down the car window. "Did you find old Teofilo?" he asked loudly. Leon stopped the truck. "Good morning, Father. We were just out to the sheep camp. Everything is okay now." "Thank God for that. Teofilo is a very old man. You really shouldn't allow him to stay at the sheep camp alone." "No, he won't do that anymore now." "Well, I'm glad you understand. I hope I'll be seeing you at Mass this week. We missed you last Sunday. See if you can get old Teofilo to come with you." The priest smiled and waved at them as they drove away. Louise and Teresa were waiting. The table was set for lunch, and the coffee was boiling on the black iron stove. Leon looked at Louise and then at Teresa. "We found him under a cottonwood tree in the big arroyo near sheep camp. I guess he sat down to rest in the shade and never got up again." Leon walked toward the old man's bed. The red plaid shawl had been shaken and spread carefully over the bed, and a new brown flannel shirt and pair of stiff new Levi's were arranged neatly beside the pillow. Louise held the screen door open while Leon and Ken carried in the red blanket. He looked small and shriveled, and after they dressed him in the new shirt and pants, he seemed more shrunken. It was noontime now because the church bells rang the Angelus. They ate the beans with hot bread, and nobody said anything until after Teresa poured the coffee. Ken stood up and put on his jacket. "I'll see about the grave diggers. Only the top layer of soil is frozen. I think it can be ready before dark." Leon nodded his head and finished his coffee. After Ken had been gone for a while, the neighbors and clanspeople came quietly to embrace Teofilo's family and to leave food on the table because the grave diggers would come to eat when they were finished. The sky in the west was full of pale yellow light. Louise stood outside with her hands in the pockets of Leon's green army jacket that was too big for her. The funeral was over, and the old men had taken their candles and medicine bags and were gone. She waited until the body was laid into the pickup before she said anything to Leon. She touched his arm, and he noticed that her hands were still dusty from the cornmeal that she had sprinkled around the old man. When she spoke, Leon could not hear her. "What did you say? I didn't hear you." "I said I had been thinking about something." "About what?" "About the priest sprinkling holy water for Grandpa, so he won't be thirsty." Leon stared at the new moccasins that Teofilo had made for the ceremonial dances in the summer. They were nearly hidden by the red blanket. It was getting colder, and the wind pushed gray dust down the narrow Pueblo road. The sun was approaching the long mesa, where it disappeared during the winter.
Louise stood there, shivering and watching his face. Then he zipped up his jacket and opened the truck door. I'll go see if he's there. Ken stopped the pickup at the church, and Leon got out, and then Ken drove down the hill to the graveyard, where people were waiting. Leon knocked at the old carved door with its symbols of the lamb. While he waited, he looked up at the twin bell towers given by the King of Spain, with the last sunlight pouring around them in their tower. The priest opened the door and smiled when he saw who it was. "Come in, what brings you here this evening?" The priest walked toward the kitchen, and Leon stood with his cap in his hand, playing with the ear flaps and examining the living room, the brown sofa, the green armchair, and the brass lamp that hung down from the ceiling by links of chain. The priest dragged a chair out of the kitchen and offered it to Leon. "No, thank you, Father. I only came to ask you if you would bring your holy water to the graveyard." The priest turned away from Leon and looked out the window at the patio, full of shadows, and the dining room windows of the nuns' cloister across the patio. The curtains were heavy, and the light from within faintly penetrated. It was impossible to see the nuns inside eating supper. "Why didn't you tell me he was dead? I could have brought the last rites anyway." Leon smiled. "It wasn't necessary, Father." The priest stared down at his scuffed brown loafers and the worn hem of his cassock. For a Christian burial, it was necessary. His voice was distant, and Leon thought that his blue eyes looked tired. "It's okay, Father. We just want him to have plenty of water." The priest sank down into the green chair and picked up a glossy missionary magazine. He turned the colored pages full of lepers and pagans without looking at them. "You know I can't do that, Leon. There should have been the last rites and a funeral mass at the very least." Leon put on his green cap and pulled the flaps down over his ears. "It's getting late, Father. I've got to go." When Leon opened the door, Father Paul stood up and said, "Wait." He left the room and came back wearing a long brown overcoat. He followed Leon out the door and across the dim churchyard to the adobe steps in front of the church. They both stooped to fit through the low adobe entrance. When they started down the hill to the graveyard, only half of the sun was visible above the mesa. The priest approached the grave slowly, wondering how they had managed to dig into the frozen ground, and then he remembered that this was New Mexico and saw the pile of cold, loose sand beside the hole. The people stood close to each other with little clouds of steam puffing from their faces. The priest looked at them and saw a pile of jackets, gloves, and scarves in the yellow, dry tumbleweeds that grew in the graveyard. He looked at the red blanket, not sure that Teofilo was so small, wondering if it wasn't some perverse Indian trick, something they did in March to ensure a good harvest, wondering if maybe old Teofilo was actually at sheep camp, corralling the sheep for the night. But there he was, facing into a cold, dry wind and squinting at the last sunlight, ready to bury a red wool blanket, while the faces of his parishioners were in shadow with the last warmth of the sun on their backs. His fingers were stiff, and it took him a long time to twist the lid off the holy water. Drops of water fell on the red blanket and soaked into dark, icy spots. He sprinkled the grave, and the water disappeared almost before it touched the dim, cold sand. It reminded him of something. He tried to remember what it was, because he thought if he could remember, he might understand this. He sprinkled more water. He shook the container until it was empty, and the water fell through the light from sundown like August rain that fell while the sun was still shining, almost evaporating before it touched the wilted squash flowers. The wind pulled at the priest's brown Franciscan robe and swirled away the cornmeal and pollen that had been sprinkled on the blanket. They lowered the bundle into the ground, and they didn't bother to untie the stiff pieces of new rope that were tied around the ends of the blanket. The sun was gone, and over on the highway, the eastbound lane was full of headlights. The priest walked away slowly. Leon watched him climb the hill, and when he had disappeared within the tall, thick walls, Leon turned to look up at the high blue mountains in the deep snow that reflected a faint red light from the west. He felt good because it was finished, and he was happy about the sprinkling of the holy water. Now the old man could send them big thunderclouds for sure. Isn't that splendid?
Yeah.
It's a little hard to understand. I wonder if there are any questions about it. I could reread a line or two.
Well, it was beautiful the way they prepared him for death right out there in the ditch. I don't know quite what the green and the yellow on him mean. Do you know?
Well, they surely were intent on having him in red, weren't they? A red blanket, and his blanket on his bed was red, too. I thought the way they prepared him for death, I mean, this was a community that just knew how to do it. They knew everything to do, they did it. And there was no fuss, no money changed hands, no hoop, you know, no anything, except they had a funeral in the home. With the old medicine men came, and they had the pollen and the corn flour, and they did the funeral in the home. They picked him up out there, they wrapped him in his red blanket, they brought him home, they changed him into clean clothes, put on his fresh moccasins that he had made for next summer's dances, new clothes and fresh moccasins, wrapped him in the red blanket, had a funeral, and then the funeral was over. They moved him into the truck, and then they brought him down to the churchyard to bury him. And they still hadn't told the priest. And they dug the hole, and they didn't tell the priest. They didn't go to the mortuary, they didn't buy a coffin, they didn't have him embalmed, they didn't, you know, they just, they took care of their dead in a beautiful and simple way.
Do you, I wonder, didn't catch on at the beginning, but then I wondered if he went out to die rather than die in the home. There was something about him dying out in the field, because when they came back, already the new jeans and shirt were waiting for him.
Yeah.
And there was no surprise that he was dead, like they anticipated it.
Yeah, it's very
interesting. And then the priest later wonders whether he was some kind of his death was some kind of part of a ritual for a better harvest. Mm-hmm. So there must be something in his experience of living with the indigenous people that this was possible.
The priest worries when he first stops, and they says, he says, don't have him go out there and work in the at the sheep camp. He's too old.
Mm.
And they say,
I knew he would die, but that was right. That was reasonable and right.
But he did. The old man did make himself a pair of moccasins, planning to dance at the next summer's festival.
That's true.
Or he made them.
Knowing.
For his long dance.
Yeah,
his long dance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The priest doesn't seem to respect Native American culture and their practices.
Although he did, because mm-hmm. he went out against his, using the word priest, against his mm-hmm. ideology there to go out and put the holy water, which shows me that the Indians had some sort of influenced by that religion, because it wasn't said towards the end until they give him water for his drink.
Mm-hmm.
She said he didn't want to have water.
Yeah, so what? First of all, what is the evidence that he doesn't respect Native Americans?
Because he, it's all the way back to meeting on the road in the beginning of the story. Native Americans respect their elders. They don't tell them what to do. They, just the tone in his dialogue that says, don't let the old man go up there. You know, he doesn't respect that they know what's best for themselves.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's respect or just not knowledge of what it is.
But he feels free to instruct them about how to do their business.
Mm-hmm. He's caught between two cultures. Mm-hmm. I think he does have a respect, but he also has his own culture that says, oh, this is what you must do when someone dies. He really believes in his own expression of his faith. And he had a sense that they were part of it. And then he has to work through, I think, his disappointment to find they're not a part of his, but then he's still willing to adapt and go and be there. So I think that's very human. I think that's what we would find ourselves in, swinging between cultures in a similar context.
Who changes in this story? Who changes the most? The priest. The priest is the one that grows. Mm-hmm. Do you remember when Leon comes to his house and takes off his cap and wants to talk to the father about whether the father will bring the holy water to the grave? The father goes, the paragraph describes the living room furniture in the priest's house. He has a green couch and he has... And then the father goes and drags a kitchen chair out of the kitchen and offers that to Leon to sit on. Why does he do that?
Because he's dirty and he doesn't want him to... He's not good enough to sit on the priest's good furniture. He can sit on the wooden chair. Mm-hmm.
So that's the second piece of evidence after this business of him telling him how to handle their old elders. And there's that. And then there is this line that says... it's probably the most offensive of the three things about the priest. The priest looked at them, the people standing by the grave, and saw a pile of jackets, gloves, and scarves in the yellow dry tumbleweeds that grew in the graveyard. He looked at the red blanket, not sure that Teofilo was so small. In other words, the man was so flat and little in the blanket that it looked like there was a blanket with nothing in it, and wondering if it wasn't some perverse Indian trick, something they did in March to ensure a good harvest. Wondering if maybe old Teofilo was actually at sheep camp, corralling the sheep for the night. But there he was, meaning there the priest was, facing into a cold, dry wind and squinting at the last sunlight, ready to bury a red wool blanket, while the faces of his parishioners were in shadow with the last warmth of sun on their backs. It's an interesting paragraph. Calling it a perverse Indian trick is kind of going to the worst end of what's in that priest's heart. That he has some sense that they would be tricking him, that they don't trust him or respect him, and so they would be tricking him.
Ironically, of course, they do hope for the rain for the harvest. The story is actually very painful, because when I was in India, we had a funeral, and from the Christian church, when we walked down the hill to the graveside, when we got there, we looked back, and there were no women, it was only men. I said, why? Well, there are evil spirits in the graveyard, and women can be made infertile. Okay, I went on, about to put the body in the grave, and they took the top off the little casket, and there on the top of the man's chest was a great iron axe. That's there to stop the evil spirits destroying the body. Then they took a knife and stripped it totally open so that the spirit could leave. All this was happening, inside a Christian ritual, and I had no idea it was going to happen. Same thing. You don't know the culture, you don't know what's hidden from the priest.
And you were the priest?
I was assisting, yeah.
I don't think, I guess I was more sympathetic to the priest. I don't think he disliked, but he was frightened. I'm guessing he was frightened that he would go right to the trick aspect of it. And it is hard to know.
But the Indians were okay with it all. That's why it's okay. Mm-hmm. They were okay.
Yeah. They say it's okay, fine. It's okay, Father. We just want him to have plenty of water. Leon says to him, when the father says, you know, you had to have last rites and you had to have a funeral mass. And Leon sort of pats him on the back and says, it's okay. It's okay. We took care of that. We did a funeral. And we just want him to have plenty of water. So they are comfortable with the holy water, the idea that water is holy, blessed water is holy. And the earlier time when he says it's okay is when the priest stops him. And again, he's sort of patting the priest on the back. The priest stops the truck and says, did you find old Teofilo? He asked loudly. Leon stopped the truck. Good morning, Father. First of all, Leon stops the truck. The father just demands, he's like I am, he says, did you find old Teofilo? He dispenses with politeness and with consideration. The Indian, instead of responding right away, says, good morning, Father. So he stands on the ceremony, he's the polite one. And then he says, we were just out to the sheep camp. Everything is okay now. What does he mean by everything is okay now?
His spirit is free. The grandfather's spirit is free. It's okay now. There's no more worry coming.
Yeah, and they also have this idea that he's the man who sends rain clouds, and they want rain. So the grandfather has gone home to the great spirits to send rain. That's what their focus is on. Having sent an ambassador from this world to the next.
I think Silke, right at the very end there at the gravesite, metaphorically tells us about the blindness of the priest. He's blinded by his own culture because he stands squinting into the sun. Yeah. And so through all of this, he really hasn't seen what's going on, whereas they have the sun at their backs and their faces are in shadow. So he doesn't understand. But so I think that's sort of a metaphorical thing. He doesn't. Or he's not even in the position to understand because he's so caught by his own culture. But I think he's accommodating. Because he's willing, even he knows he doesn't understand, and he's got disappointment in his heart, yet at the same time, he's willing to accommodate, to adjust, to follow through on what they want. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a thing of not putting somebody into a box to say, you're just there. That is, I like the way that Silke leaves the priest as multidimensional rather than just blinded by the culture. And, you know, you often get these illustrations where people are stuck.
Yeah.
And they're caught by their culture and they don't try anything. This is actually showing the complexity.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The priest is not an evil person at all. Yeah. And the priest is the one person who's shown to grow and change in the story. The Indians are fluid in it. I think they're fluid in their culture. They're comfortable in their culture, and they're comfortable accommodating the priest who wants them to come to Mass and, you know, who wants to Christianize them. But they don't move in this. Their culture comes through for them at a time when it's needed. The first line of the story, to me, conveys a kind of attitude, or the first several lines. They found him under a big cottonwood tree. What is the effect of that language? How does it make, does it do anything for you?
I don't know what a cottonwood tree is.
It's a big old
tree with a lot of leaves and it's got a big top, and in the certain seasons of the year it lets go of cotton and it flies for, the seeds fly for...
It's like a poplar, a very fast growing tree.
This one happened to be a hot place.
And they grow in dry places where...
Which I showed up to the other day.
A lot of authors, especially a less accomplished author, would tell us right away who they is and who him is. She would want to be assuring us that we were not left out of some information here. But she just goes with they and him. They found him under a big cottonwood tree. His Levi jacket and pants were faded light blue, so he'd been easy to find. The big cottonwood tree stood apart. So she goes and describes the situation without trying to get into our brains and say, this is who I'm talking about, and this is what the situation is, and old Teofilo's been missing, and now they've been out looking for him, and finally they come across a hill, and they see a cottonwood tree down there, and they see some light blue, and, you know, she doesn't do any of that. She just has a kind of simplicity and an almost airiness, very spare language, very simple and dignified language. And they don't say anything about the affect. They don't say the men cried, or the men gasped, the men held each other's hand, the men ran fearfully up to the body to see if he was dead. They just have him find him. And then one of them doesn't even approach the body. He goes and gets the truck and brings the truck and slides down the wall of the arroyo and brings the red blanket. Before they wrapped the old man, Leon took a piece of string out of his pocket and tied a small gray feather in the old man's long white hair. So they had the string along, they had the feather along, they had the red blanket in the truck, and then the next lines are all about the paint that they put on the man's face. They had the paint along. Ken gave him the paint across the brow, and Ken gave him the paint. What paint, I say, I who am a busybody, you know?
Well, they were expecting to find him.
Right, that's
dead.
Right.
They were not expecting to find him walking through the pasture.
Right.
Is it
so they came prepared with what they needed to begin their ceremony, which was the red blanket and the paint.
Is there any point in the story which this does describe what you're saying and the emotions of the people when they saw him, when they... Is there any reference to human emotions, or is it simply implied all the way through?
That's a good question, and one of the places to look for the answer is in the places where there are meetings of people or conflicts. When the two men come home, the way that there are three little dots separated the first set of paragraphs, which ends with the priest encounter on the road. And then the next line is, Louise and Teresa were waiting. The table was sent for lunch, and the coffee was boiling on the black iron stove. Leon looked at Louise, and then at Teresa. So the men came home with the body of Grandpa, and they didn't say, oh, sit down, I've got a shock for you. They look at the women, and something about the simple dignity of that expression is enough. And then they give them the information. We found him under a cottonwood tree in the big arroyo near Sheep Camp. I guess he sat down to rest in the shade and never got up again.
It's all the emotion seems to be inside. I mean. Because, I mean, well, it's hard to imagine that you can lose Grandpa without some sadness. Even though you want to do this for him, and you're happy that he's gone to bring water to you, how could you not be sad?
Yeah.
Well, what's interesting to me is in both of those stories, where the child isn't shown to have a lot of emotion, and this, the family isn't shown to have a lot of emotion. Maybe it's like you're painting a picture of emotions or what we bring to the picture and how we respond to it. I don't know, because I've seen that in a lot of writers. It is puzzling.
But they didn't say anything for that moment. Remember in there it says they didn't say anything. There was a moment of silence.
But the whole lunchtime.
So that kind of is the reverence. That's kind of their feeling.
Reverence, yeah, that's a good word.
That's their feeling.
And then... Then they get ready for the grave diggers, and then there's silence. She touched his arm. Louise touches Leon's arm, and he noticed that her hands were still dusty from the cornmeal that she had sprinkled around the old man. So he's attending to her, and she's attending to him just through that physical touch. When she spoke, Leon could not hear her. What did you say? I didn't hear you. Now, why couldn't he hear her? She was standing right next to him, touching his arm.
He was choked up.
Or the emotion was so intense, or something was going on so that he was so intent on an inner feeling or on something that he couldn't hear what his wife said standing there, touching his arm.
There are a lot of biblical narratives just tell the story without having the emotion as well.
Mm-hmm.
A good example is the story about when Abraham is told to go and sacrifice his son. And all through that story, there are subtle things, but no reference. Like the boy says, oh, here's the wood, Dad, but where's the lamb?
Mm-hmm.
Never any reference to the emotion, child, or the father. It's amazing, and that kind of art of writing is common in some of those good stories, biblical stories too.
In my family, I have 5 siblings, and in my family, when I call one of my siblings and give a report about a different sibling, if I just say some words about what that sibling did, that conveys emotion in a way that I don't get all emotional. None of us do. We're Norwegians, of course, we're Catholic. But there's something that's, among people who are intimate with each other, there's an intimacy about not having to splash the emotion out big, but to say, I know you so well that I know what's going on inside of you when this is happening, when something big is happening or deep is happening. There's a sort of subtlety I think the author assumes human emotion, assumes that we understand these people are having deep feelings, because she assumes all human beings would have deep feelings when they lose their grandfather whom they love. And so there's this kind of dignity in saying, I don't need to show that to you. But she shows us in very subtle ways, like saying, Leon doesn't even hear his wife because he's so intensely feeling something. His ears are closed. So he doesn't hear her when she speaks to him. And then she speaks to him about the priest going and asking the priest for the holy water. And then how does the decision make? This is something that Leon, do you think Leon is looking forward to going to the priest and telling him, oh, by the way, Teofilo died and we've had a funeral and we're about to bury him and we'd like you to bring holy water? Does Leon want to say that? Is he longing to go through the big thick walls into the priest's house? Probably not. So she asks him, and he loves her. So what does he do? What did you say? I didn't hear you. I said I had been thinking about something. She says, about what? He says, about the priest sprinkling holy water for Grandpa so he won't be thirsty. Leon stared at the new moccasins that Teofilo had made for the ceremonial dances in the summer. They were nearly hidden by the red blanket. So instead of Leon saying, oh, go and ask him yourself, or I don't want to do that, or we don't need holy water for him, we can bring our own water, he stares at the body that's laying there and is quiet. Then it talks about time passing. It says it was getting colder and the wind pushing gray dust down the narrow Pueblo road.
The sun was approaching the long mesa where it disappeared during the winter. So a lot of time passes. He's standing there staring at his grandpa's moccasins. His wife is standing looking at him, wondering if he's going to go and get the holy water. And neither one of them, they don't quarrel, they don't get into it, they don't discuss it further, they don't go out and lay out the pros and cons. Louise stood there shivering and watching his face. Then he zipped up his jacket and opened the truck door. I'll go see if he's there. So something happens there. They think through that.
Is it because on the road they didn't tell him? He said, did you find your grandfather? I forget the grandfather's name. Yeah. And the grandchildren response was, oh, I don't think he's going to be doing that anymore. Opposed to, oh, he did.
Yeah.
So is it because of that? They're like, man, we didn't even tell him he was dead, but now we want to ask him to do the holy water.
Yeah.
And I want to ask another question concerning that story. They had some paint, and it was painting smiley face. Was this a portrait, or were they actually painting on the grandfather, or did they paint a portrait on a tree or something?
That's a good question. Let me show you. Let me read it for you again. First, they tied a feather in his hair, okay, in his long white hair. Ken gave Leon the paint. Across the brown wrinkled forehead, he drew a streak of white.
Okay.
And along the high cheekbones, he drew a strip of blue paint. He paused and watched Ken throw pinches of cornmeal and pollen into the wind that fluttered the small gray feather. Then Leon painted with yellow under the old man's broad nose. And finally, when he had painted green across the chin, he smiled. Send us rain clouds, grandfather, he says. So he speaks to him. First he puts this ceremonial paint on him, and then he speaks to his grandfather.
So these are Indians?
No.
Okay, so now I get that.
Okay.
Well, it's hard when you have to look in front of you to pick up. Please.
It's hard when something is read exactly. Yes, thank you. I wonder what the... Yeah?
You seem great.
But that painting also is like the anointing that the priest, the women says, okay, it's okay. That's what the priest would have done in anointing.
Yes.
They've done it with the paint.
So it's a deep following of their faith. The Indians are following a deep faith that says paint the face, speak to the grandfather, sprinkle pollen and corn dust around him, which is symbolically to bring back life and to, you know, have the dead be give birth to something new. Then they want the water so that the man will send rain clouds, which is the title of the story, the man to send rain clouds. So Teofilo becomes the man to send rain clouds to them. You know, somebody else might pray for rain, but they are sending their dead grandfather to ask the great spirits to send rain. So they're being very ritualistic. They're very much into their culture and their ritual. They're very comfortable in their culture, and they know what to do. And they are what we Lutherans would call the priesthood of all believers. Because they, in the Lutheran Church, there's an idea that everybody should know enough to know how to practice their faith. And these Indians know enough to practice their faith.
So with the conflict thing, they don't get confrontational with each other.
Right.
They just, if one asks other to do something, they will pause, but go ahead and do it anyway. Is that like a source of any confrontation?
Yeah, they don't fight.
Verbally either. I hear they wasn't verbally in conflict either. Mm-hmm.
But they might, I suppose they could decide not to do something too.
Okay.
But they wouldn't fight. It sounds like here they're not going to fight about it. And when the priest says, you know, I can't come and sprinkle holy water on him. You didn't have last rites. You didn't have a mass. You didn't do all that stuff that you have to do before you get holy water. And Leon says, it wasn't necessary, Father. And then the priest stared down at his scuffed brown loafers and the worn hem of his cassock. For a Christian burial, it was necessary. His voice was distant, and Leon thought that his blue eyes looked tired. It's okay, Father. We just want him to have plenty of water. The priest sank down into the green chair and picked up a glossy missionary magazine. He turned the colored pages full of lepers and pagans without looking at them. You know I can't do that, Leon. There should have been at least the last rites and a funeral mass. Leon put on his green cap and pulled the flaps down over his ears. It's getting late, Father. I have to go. So does he fight with the priest about it? The priest says, no, you didn't do the right thing.
You avoid conversation.
He just puts on his cap and says, and then the priest says, wait. So the priest grows and changes. I mean, the priest is clearly suffering in this situation. He's depressed by it and he's upset by it.
And I think he's depressed, feeling powerless. He's looking at these glossy missionary magazines. He envisioned himself as, having great power, and he realizes that he doesn't know beans about this culture or how to share.
All they want is water.
Yeah.
And not only that, but he has felt like, y'all could have, invited me to do these things. Y'all didn't trust me, and, he didn't feel apart.
So then he realizes, that his missionary work, his work there to save the natives.
Absolutely.
He hasn't gotten as far as he thought.
He hasn't gotten as far as he hoped he had.
Does he actually then, he sprinkles the water and then he says, oh gosh, I'll give him the lot, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He gives him the lot.
He just throws the whole bottle.
He gives it all.
He doesn't just have it all. And then Leslie Marmon Silko, from her point of view, points out that the water almost disappears before it hits the red blanket because it is so dry there. And then when it hits the red blanket, it turns dark and freezes immediately, turns to ice. So who knows what this holy water is going to do. But the Indians are perfectly happy with it. They smile. He felt good because it was finished, and he was happy about the sprinkling of the holy water. Now the old man could send them big thunder clouds for sure.
Because he was all painted up for the ceremony and he had his new moccasins.
And his water.
Well, they have the Indian cultural burial, but then they're thinking there might be something to this Christianity thing too. So let's use that too and just make sure we got our bases covered.
Exactly.
Make sure it's possible.
Yeah, nobody said they were stupid.
I think we could go on talking about this story for a long time, but thank you very much.
Thank you.